Dr. Hill Explains, where I invite you to join the science teaching conversation with me about the circulation system. That's the heart, veins, arteries, that type of stuff. And just a general, sort of slightly more in-depth knowledge development of it. Now, there's several backstories which I have to perhaps go through first. One is that, as you'll hear, this is done probably at night. You probably can hear some of the night noises while I'm doing a rehab walk at night. I have to do so much walking a day, so much activity, actually doing a little bit of boxing and that type of stuff, just part of overall recovery. That's sort of a combination recovery for cardiac and cognitive recovery. So that's the way that you think and remember and stuff like that. And that sort of recovery, I've started off doing podcasting as a way to speak. And ever so slowly can I actually get some interest, coherence and some lines so you don't go to sleep listening. I can even bear speaking it. And so behind that is obviously the structure of podcasting to teach, eventually get up there. And so another layer is programming, computer programming and structuring, again for cognitive stuff, to actually lay out some of the ideas and eventually link little pieces together. So the overall idea is to provide an outlet or a structure for which the podcasting can go. So there's the I forgot what it's actually called. Peter Hill Podcasts, Peter Hill Teach Me Podcasts. I forgot what the Dr. Hill Explains, or Dr. Hill Teach, and various Dr. Hill Teach Me is some of the podcasts linking up. And there's that general sort of understanding of putting out a shingle, as they say, you sort of setting up your little lemonade stall at the side of the road, and with 5 cents for lemonade, and seeing who will come along to set it up there. So it's very much get up there. And of course there's problems or areas I'd love to know, like how you do it properly in WordPress, and get feed blitz operating. Sort of push along there, and big questions, scratching your head, Twitter. You know, there's various things. How does that all structure together? But the main thing in terms of the software is get it pumping out reliably and quickly each time, and building up a library of parts that you can rebuild. Now for the actual teaching, it's pretty hard to actually teach an engaging lesson on a podcast. It's unlikely that you'll hit a podcast which is relevant enough and high level enough for a podcast listener or listening audience. I very much doubt that people want to listen to a podcast which instead they can actually go and see David Attenborough, or see a good YouTube documentary where it's explained. It's trying to get in behind the scenes and trying to look at some of the structure. So some of the people have been listening to Podomation podcasts where I explain things, or, you know, this is how I'm going to design an experiment podcast, rather than the experiment itself. I describe in detail how I'm going to build or attempt to build an experiment. So there's interest there. So as I'm programming away and applying different theories, I've come with this, and this is all leading up there. So let's recap at this point in time. I'm the motivation for podcasting is cognitive rehab, sort of your brain rehab, so you can actually communicate much faster and at a higher level, trying to achieve that. And why do it while walking? Well, that's sort of ideally, you know, the maximum, apparently the maximum cognitive rehab is actually walking backwards. Perhaps I mightn't do that. I have to be very cautious to see how I do. I think that would absolutely get myself knocked off. Now, coming up, you've got sort of this, as you podcast and focus, you realise that there are certain structures. As you go to explain something, and you're not restricted by explaining something to be consistent with where it's taught. There you go. A little car coming past. There's actually walking at night here. There's, you know, beautiful little houses around with little people with their Christmas lights up. I suppose we should get some Christmas lights up. It's sort of be, because everyone puts such a big effort in a house on, it would be just a few blinky lights. I don't think it's going to be really impress anybody. Okay, getting there, there's the idea of a podcast. Well, how does it operate? Well, in fact, this student needs many bites of the cherry and many different forms of a podcast. And so one can actually... There's a friend coming home from an evening up there. Yeah, there's many forms of the podcast. And so looking at the many forms of the podcast and... the structure out there and some of the tools built to recast and resplice podcasts together, and the general ability for software to do things. It means that so this task is a very repetitive task of correcting exams, correcting students, preparing work for them. So you prepare work for once and then they have to go away and do it. So the idea is that you have the same podcast broken up into different segments. There's the trailer segment, which just introduces it. There's the radio program version. There's the class version, the class test version with an answer sheet. Now, that's just going to be... we'll just talk about... And then there's just the information only. So depending on what the student wants to do or have the time that they have available, they have different bites of the cherry looking through. Now, essentially, multiple choice format is something which is easily added by computer. And essentially, a random number generator assigns values, and it gives you an order. And basically, I must admit, I have never really thought about it. Quite honestly, the just write the code, and gee whiz, it sort of almost works before I've even understood what I've done, and. One of the things is you want a printed out answer sheet for some reason. So you can have the read out answer sheet, which is there, or you can skip and just get everyone to correct it off the board. And writing the HTML to it, I just sort of knew where the answers were pulled out and just stuck it in. Switching my head, I can remember how that's done. So you've got the same information, and what we're aiming for is to start what you call moving ahead, and that's so I do a piece of work, and then I can multiply it up by having it in four formats available. I suppose with the internet, so it's, if you could try to think of it, a current teacher doing one thing, I can get them, even though I'm not in the classroom and not yet there, I can get a multiplication factor of four out there, and then we can start doing things by apply some education theory of asking the question after the explanation. It flows better going through, so it's clearly thought out that the answer will be definitely given by the explanation if you ask the question after. That's a reverse structure. So I'm supposed to be fit. I'm just taking it slowly up this hill at the moment. Sorry for putting up against like that. So in that overall idea is that there's certain things that you just, you know, really annoy you, so to speak. So so the first couple of quizzes have been on chemistry and electrons, my field. Then I moved off to the first sort of physics exercise, and an area where people can experiment for themselves. You know, immediately get something off two balls and bounce it off, and you get this effect. You know, they play the sport. It's a very physical engagement area. So moving down there and giving structures of questions that once you understand the answer to one set, you can unlock the next to come through. And so that's so there's all these different different paths, so many different paths to look at. At what stage do you start approaching different institutions to get people into putting into different levels? It's a basic set of automation software where the entry point to the software, you know, the file that you present to the software is an Audacity file, and everyone can do Audacity. You just have to be trained on what exactly to do with them. So that's got a great potential for suddenly outsourcing. So not only do I have one lesson work multiplied up to four, and the ability to put and track it in there, some levels of automation, and I have the ability to get other people doing lessons. Will they want to do it? I think so. Down the track, I think people want to do it. Now, bear in mind, I did promise I'll do a heart story, and I've got a bit of a walk to do it. I'm just really trying to think. And there is a story here that there's that level, but also the understanding of how the material goes in. Now, you can have you basically need a resource that you generate your multiple choices from. So the multiple choices aren't just a random, let's cherry pick amongst different knowledge just to get a statistical snapshot. This is multiple choice, or as a training tool, which is, you know, it's what you're aiming for. And also, to improve the sort of psychology of your explanation. So it's a slightly different theme. So, just reversing for a moment, the software tool gives us, the ability to do a lot more, to have a lot more people involved. And then there's starting to, engender structure. You know, it's a strange thing, of where you build up, build up context. Now, that means that you have to have a, what happens now is that I have 10 questions, I write down the 10 questions, I sort of begin to order them and get the structure into them. Now, that's okay if there's an area which I've really thought of, it's really under control. If I'm not, it's a bit harder task. So this is where this podcast come in. And I'm going to start after I cover another area. I've got a fair way to walk. I'm just outside Glenbrook Station, and it's a fair walk to the National Park at this point. You're starting to look at that, and hopefully that structure will start to flow through. So you've got hopefully I'll get my first user critique. You know, I don't like that this is too loud or too much. I've already had too much music, white spaces, you know, blank spaces in it, and getting on top of the audio stuff. Unfortunately, I mucked up the last one by not plugging in my microphone. So I was speaking to it and moving this microphone around. The sound waves were the same, and there was that suspicious recording in stereo. But the two, so there was all these things speaking to me, but I just missed it. So I produced a fairly crappy piece, but I'm able to do some basic Audacity sound editing to just at least improve it a little bit. There's that sort of basic expectation. So that's what essentially happens, that you get people to review it. They just tell you some real basic stuff, and you can't really go high-handed. Oh no, I'm not interested in it. But we've got some more deeper structural problems of getting a linear growth thing on the 10 multiple choice questions. How deeply and how intriguingly can you get it to it? And sort of the understanding that it's not about getting 10 out of 10. It's about having a guess yourself, coming away learning, oops, well, that's by making a more memorable learning experience. So it behoves me to structure things, and I'm beginning to know that I'll have to structure things. So as I've practiced touch typing, that's a bit of a mind number. I'm sort of did, you know, reasonable linear improvement up to about 35 words a minute, and there I have stuck. And the only difference is that I can do more 35 words a minute typing. I can do more of those in a row before I flag and die. I can't beat that 35 words a minute, but the effect is that once my typing speed increased by a factor of 3, can you imagine that? That was really slow, and yeah, mistake area. I can do more podcasts. I can write more on a podcast, so you've seen it there, but it means that I have to hang on back and start to reread and structure and work out a structure for it. And similarly here for the quiz, produce the quiz, I'm going to have to start working on a base structure and an advisory structure. So there's certain advisory things I'm going to have to produce. A YouTube for, sorry, video, they call it. I always get told off, there's no such thing as a YouTube, it's a video. You have to do a video tutorial about how to operate the quiz toolkit. Now, I've tried to make it more easy to read, put it in a table format. Trying to work out why that table format doesn't go up to Blogger. But, nice one. You also probably want to, I'll put it off as a web page, and so that will be nice and neat. Just stopping on there, of course, it's just this HTTPS secure one. I'm paying for it, and it's free at Just Host. I just don't have enough technical expertise to work out, can I migrate up to that? What happens? How does it operate? It's just mind-blowing as to what it's doing. But so that's just, I've had to use Google Docs to store a few pictures that I use, and then those pictures go up to the browser, and that's clean. So this is all that little work to get going. So that sounds a bit incoherent. It's all going well, but what it means is that I have to get through the work. And I'm really aware that, say, as I think of something, I think sort of spontaneously about, okay, well, I'm just going to launch into it. And so I'll just go through what I did with the sports stuff. And that's a golf ball being hit. Thought, oh yeah, I can do frames of references and slingshot effect, you know, pretty easily. And people following the syllabus will not do that till very afterwards, and you've lost half your kids by the time you do it. So once you've done that, you can actually do the tennis ball on a basketball, and then you can sort of start to grab a few low-hanging fruits, ask these basic questions, and get basic principles involved. So it's a different idea of the way of teaching to get through. And then the natural expansion of, well, what would happen if you put a marble on top of a tennis ball on top of a ball to go down. So that's I can actually feel my heart at this point in time going through. It's sort of really, I know you're in podcast land and you can only hear things, and so it's pointless me saying that there are some pretty amazing Christmas lights. And I must admit I am still amazed and awed by the LED. There's so many little points of light, and it's just eerie compared to when I was a kid. You had to, I think, 30 milliamp, 15 volt tree lights, and you probably get 30 in a tree. And people go, whoa. And now I'm looking across the gardens of just, don't care, just reel it out, hundreds of lights all over the place. Okay, look, getting back to there's the need to actually do a quiz. So rather than relying on the natural sense of how a lesson can go, I've actually got to move into an area. I do a bit of a talk about it first, then from that talk, extract. And so that actually means that there's a couple of things. There's the podcast, then there's the quiz segment from it, as a thing to go together. So it actually does make sense. Now, that being said, looking at multiple choice and student feedback, I think I've got this one pretty well nailed. And I think I'm, and look, bear in mind, I'm not saying this to skite to anyone. I've got sort of no friends. No one's interested in what I'm doing in teaching. There's like no one's asking any questions. So I'm not standing up against in front of anybody saying, look, please promote me or anything like this. However, what I've come across is high speed scanning, and you really want a high speed scanner, and the student work is conveyed for one lesson, and then it's also accessible. So it's basically databases. You can database access it. Now, what's available? There's all this thing. Oh, you can actually scan multiple choice quizzes. Now, to myself, it's a really almost limited value, especially when you give such way out stuff, and the point is that the kid really has to move towards you. They have to say, I didn't understand that. How does that make me feel? Do I feel motivated to learn? Have I learnt something? You're encouraging it rather than just, she got 30 out of 40 in a multiple choice test quiz. You can be like Johnny Block. It's just complete bizarre bizarre things. That's one track. There's another track by, hey, what did you find out? What do you know? What motivates you? That's sort of more laid-back stuff. However, that being said, there's this technology track, which is just the way to do it. I really am a bit contemptuous. I've had a quick look at the mobile phone scanner. So what happens is you hold a mobile phone above the multiple choice and it automatically gives a mark and it pops the mark up against the person. And look, I must admit, I just think that's pretty blah. What I would like to do is basically, I think that the moment you take the multiple choice questions away from the student, you've got this huge cognitive load to, oh, what did I ask? What was it? You've got to reconstruct this huge things. So what I would like to do is soup up the scanning software. So already I've got a really high-powered scanner, and it really does a class in 10 seconds. And so what you need to do is have basically a multiple choice where the student at the top has six columns or 26 letters where they mark the first three letters of their first name, first three letters of their surname. Okay, I think machine reading of student writing is a nightmare. Generic multiple choice, 0 to 10, if you use it. Fairly simple. And again, I think it's the standard stuff's a nightmare. You basically want to actually take their work, scan it through, it automatically has a multiple choice before or after feedback survey. There could be feedback survey questions and just some handwriting and some most important things to feedback. So there's a way to go across there. Now, LabVIEW does that absolutely screamingly big, much better than anything else. Yes, so it's this iMac. This has nothing to do with IMAQ machine vision software. Really, you could get the design in an afternoon. So what that means is that you know, there's several things. Like, I'm publishing the atoms to the internet, and it's just to actually get put out the software where people can select, I'll take this question, these questions in this order, make up a test, randomize it for me. Just the way to do it, and actually have people listen to the text, so that's voice to text. So although the multiple choice are voice activated, you can have a text version of it. Now, the most important thing is to build a quality system. Now, I don't think building a quality system is my... I can sort of design it how it works, but if it's just bad spirits, I don't want anything to do with it type of stuff. It's not going to... Oh, look, I'm going to design it and build it anyway. But this is where your multiple choice goes out as atoms. People can then submit the listen to it, you know, type things out, clean it up as a written multiple choice, and then as they're atoms, as words, you can pull them up. You need to sort of tags, so it's a real database nightmare. So I can get the basic stuff out there, but eventually it's a big plan, and I think it's going to be the way to go. Just from my automation experience, this is going to be the way to go. But that all being said, that's looking at that area. I've got to actually drill down in the expertise of the sequence of doing a quiz. I think really the first sequence of doing a quiz is doing a podcast on the actual topic and just having a bit of a chew, see how you go. As if you don't go anywhere, you might go and study after it. If you get stuck doing the podcast, then a little mull on it for a while, write the notes out, and then hit the record stuff. And it's still taking me a bit of half an hour to do 10 questions in a podcast, and then, I don't know, it's shameful, about an hour going through just picking out bits of software errors. You're not necessarily software errors, but your HTML generated by the computer. So you don't write the HTML, the computer has got certain rules and it resources and writes the HTML. It still makes, it's only as good as the stuff you put in it, so you put it through a validator. So that's probably spent an hour producing the, oh, what is it? Probably half an hour writing the test, an hour producing it, and then 2 hours just stuffing around, just having a look at it. It's pretty amazing how quickly you forget what you've done once it's up and running. You sort of just accept it as another user. So we're at the point where I want to do something about the circulation system, and I've got a sense for quizzes which really open things up. Now, the circulation system is a bit obvious. I've had these big operations, and going along, you come across and the doctors are saying something, and they say, oh, look, the little valve we're putting in, it's a metal valve, and you've researched it, and you know it's not metal. Okay, and then you get cardiac rehab, and the nurses there, so 4 chambers in the heart, because this is what I used to teach, 4 chambers in the heart. However, what happened is that when I did an animation of it, or did the bio body, I saw, oh, there's 6 chambers in the heart. And then when I did a diagram explaining it, I said, oh, it's not 4 valves, there's actually 6 valves, because it, I'm used to making hydraulic circuits for robots and air circuits for robots too. And I'm very much aware of valves because you use that in eczema lasers. You don't want your fluorine. You put fluorine into the laser, and you've got fluorine in the tube between your fluorine. This is fluorine gas, you know. Pretty toxic. Not toxic. It's not. I don't think it's as toxic. Honestly, I don't think it's as toxic as chlorine gas. But fluorine gas, and you put it in, you put these one-way valves. And so designing gas delivery systems for eczema lasers, it's got a circulation system of sorts. It definitely has a circulation system. Eczema lasers, like some of the good old eczema lasers have a little fan just to inside, vacuums in with a big fan inside it. These are pretty big beasts, pretty entertaining things, and magnetic, but all these things, but you just wouldn't put the components down, you wouldn't go, oh, right, well, let's go that way, oh, well, it's there, when I press that, it'll go backwards, and, well, if it puts into that chamber, So there's a way to do it. So there's the chamber system, and then looking at the actual the computer animation, I go up to where my bypass is, sort of scanning in, flying through on YouTube. It's not on the left heart part of the heart. No, it's actually behind the heart. You know, what? Behind the heart? And it's not, I'm not making it up. You actually get this experience and then you start to realize all these things. So let's perhaps start there. That the fundamental thing of a pump is a flexible chamber, right? Flexible chamber which compresses and it can load in. It's a container which is relaxed and blood flows in through a one non-return valve, and then when it's compressed it doesn't return through that non-return valve and then flows out. So there are six of those chambers. Okay, there's four. Everyone's known left and right ventricle and atrium. Okay, they're the same. Oh, I'm just going to do it a bit more simply here. So your fundamental system of the heart is, I've never heard it explained that way before, but it's the way it goes. I think it's the way most people understand it. Is that the fundamental unit of the heart is a non-return valve in, a pressure, a thing which can, when triggered, apply pressure, and a non-return valve out. So it goes in one way. And four of those chambers can be triggered, two of those chambers take high pressure blood and bleed it down. Actually, put it down. Now I think I might be actually up for but now this, unfortunately, guys, it means that I'm going to breathe. I really don't understand my level of fitness, quite honestly. So it's up there, okay, but it's sort of nothing compared to average people. I don't know, it's a bit hard. Okay, so we've got this basic idea that there's these chambers which will fill up if when they've squeezed out. Let's start from, they've just squeezed out and pumped the blood into the next section. And then the chamber before them has to activate sufficiently to get past the non-return valve and close. The thump thump is valve closing. So it's like people walking through a door and slamming the door behind them. That thump is a valve slamming shut. So with me, I had thump, like that, my valve was stuffed, and now I've got a thump, ting, a little ting, as my, I've had a valve replaced. And can I say, thank you, doctors, I'm in, this is Peter Hill Mark 2.0, I've started up again. I was scheduled for deletion, and they've rebuilt me, but I'm sort of software code with no applications. No one's buying me off the shelf, except I suppose you could call it artificial intelligence. Or I'm just adding more and more to go ahead. Okay, so this is the fundamental aspect of it, and essentially this is a circular system. So you can imagine your garden hose, you hook up your garden hose in such a way that they go to these little units of the expandable bladder. So it expands to come in. Now the pressure is such in the next chamber, so that's high. So what happens is it pumps out and pressurizes the next chamber, and so that locks the valve in front of it, and then it's got no pressure in it, so it's now ripe for the chamber just before it to pump into it. So it's got to be a sequence of things like that. That's the way it happens in the heart. So let's start working through the left-hand side of the heart. Now, the important thing is that it's not the left-hand side of the heart. It's actually the rear side of the heart. I don't know what people are saying, but it is definitely the rear side of the heart. The back of the heart pumps to the body. And we'll start off with the point in time that the ventricle, which is the main, most powerful pump. You may as well start off with the most powerful pump. That's a good look. I would say you've got a good half inch of powerful muscle. Powerful muscle which never gets tired. So skin cells and stuff like that have one sugar to power unit, one mitochondria. Your heart blood cells have 5,000 of these. They just never get tired. Any sugar there, they convert it. They're sort of just, you do your stuff, heart. So it's a pretty powerful muscle of heart stuff, and that fills up. Well, that's good. So when it's relaxed and it's been emptied, it's low pressure, and so it can be just drip fed, and we'll get back to it. So it's a ventricle, and then it pumps, compresses, and it pushes its way through these balloons of into an artery, but the artery has these three little balloons. So when the artery's got high blood pressure in it, and those balloons fill up with that water and block the tube, and there's generally three of these balloon sections, and they fill with blood, high pressure blood, and seal the ventricle. This is your high blood pressure thing. So we'll call that number one, and it's been filled by number six. Okay, but we've got a few other two extra chambers. So in your circulation system, your heart has four small chambers. Your heart proper has six chambers. We'll get onto that. And your circulation system, fully engineering wise, has eight chambers. How do you get that? Yeah, and I must admit, people say, "Oh, you know." Amazingly abusive, and they slam the door, walk away, and you go, all right, what have I learnt? Oh, this person is really addicted to culture, because this, you know, that's how it works. You know, there's no doubt about it. So we've done chamber one, which is the ventricle. It squeezes up, squeezes into the next chamber, which is the aortal chamber, which is really all the artery system in your entire body is another chamber. But what happens is this has got high pressure blood, and this high pressure blood, as soon as that's got the pressure in the aorta, in the ventricle, drops, these balloons go pop, 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 pop. They all fill up, and you can imagine party balloons that, these big party balloons in a doorway, and they just fill the doorway. You just can't get in. You can, if you want to, you can push. If you've got high pressure blood, you can push. These will fall back and push apart. So that's your valve. Now, with me, I had a two-way one rather than a three-way one. Thank you, Charles Darwin. I have a chat to you about what you decided I'd be experimenting on the not-so-successful evolutionary thing. But fortunately, modern science has come along and said, all right, that doesn't work. We can do this loving, caring, herbal cow version for you. Or we can give you this one made out of quantum mechanically grown super carbon material from nuclear missiles. I'm not joking about any of it. It lasts a cool 10 to the 7 years. That is, its mean time between failures is 10 million years. This is some geological time. Given that the human race has not existed that way, you know, if we go 10 million years into the past, we were shrews up trees, being eaten by God knows what. I would have preferred 64 million years. I'm sure there'll be an improved version. However, if they bring out why 64 million years? Because I would have been able to say, going back, I would have said, hello, dinosaurs. Look at that. Look at that big light in the sky rushing towards us. 64. But 10 million years is quite good. So thank you, unearthly science. And it's a pretty amazing stuff. I'm under no illusions that really the body is the best. Well, obviously my body wasn't the best, but if you put in something mechanical, it's you're a fool if you believe it's going to be absolutely hunky dory. Nothing's going to go wrong. It's going to go wrong. Okay, getting back, we've done that first one. It goes into the aorta. Now the aorta is not a nerved. Well, it is sort of nerves. It's the thing that gives you high blood pressure. That's you. When they're measuring your blood pressure, it is measuring the actual pressure of your aorta. That higher number is the aorta blood pressure. That is, what sort of pressure does it take to actually crush aorta? Now, although your aorta is like a candy cane, it's actually like, you know, those big candy canes for Christmas. Not, they're sort of about half an inch across, coming around. It is that shape. It is a candy cane shape because it gets to go down. And though some of it's saying on the length of the candy cane, oh yeah, brain, I'll do you, brain, I'll look after you. But really, I've got to get to the legs to help that little beastie run away. So it goes down, the candy cane goes down to around the base of your stomach. And this is a tube, and it doesn't have to be that thick, alright? But it's that thick for a fair while to store a certain amount of blood. And all your arteries are, in actual fact, a chamber. You've actually got a chamber of your heart that stretches throughout of you. And all of that is a muscle, and the muscle relaxes. Right, relaxes when the high blood pressure goes in. Says, all right, but then it goes, right, and I'm going to maintain that pressure. So what happens is that, say if it was pipe, a water pipe, all right? What will happen is that some jerk will open it up for a little bit, give you a bit more water, and close it off again. You know, like this is the ventricle going chamber one. We're talking chamber two now. Now what happens is, if I open that, the water would drip out and the pressure would suddenly drop. Like you'd fill up your cup and then the next cup wouldn't go, and it would just, if you'd have that when your water's cut up. Unless the pipes were all rubbers, and it released, and it was smart, and it would keep on shrinking and actually squeeze out all the blood, and maintaining it at constant pressure. So what happens is your massive chamber one, the ventricle, goes, the back of your heart, and that's got super high pressure. So what happens is that your aorta and all that type of stuff goes, whoa, relax, and it's been extended. And then what it does is this muscle contracts and pumps the blood through your body. Okay, so there's stuff pumping through your heart, pumps your aorta, and your aorta then pumps the blood through the rest of your body. Okay, then, so we've done one valve. The next valve is your veins. Your veins are a very long valve. That is, every part of your vein has one of these little balloons, and it stops the blood flowing back. Veins can only support blood in one direction. That is, and people go, unfortunately, because I am speak to so many more people, I have imaginary people I speak to who just object, go, are very negative, and they'll say, the veins, they're veins, they're tubes, that have a valve function, but they're not valves. Okay, they are valves. They are basically a valve. Okay, so this is a valve section. So your chamber two is really your aorta and your arteries, and they compress. And if you get tense, your blood pressure goes up. It's not because your heart doesn't make your blood pressure go up. Your brain is sending contraction signals to your aorta. Okay, so your aorta goes along, and you basically, your heart can stop pumping, you can be dead, and then you stab someone in the neck, and their blood will squirt out at high speed. And it's not you see those gruesome murders and people squirt blood everywhere, it's not their pump, it's their heart pump. It's just too complicated for the heart. It's pumping here, it's not. The actual squirt is your aorta draining down. You've got a bit of blood supported there. So the blood then goes through a resistance. So if you're drawing a circuit, a load, and these are the very fine capillaries, and there's a bit more to what's going on there. And then it goes into the veins, which is the valve. And so really you've got a chamber number two is your aorta with the veins, the valve, and that goes back up to chamber number three in your heart again. But this is again goes to the front of your heart, called the atrium, up the top. Your atrium is the same deal. Blood goes in, it squeezes out through another valve into the front ventricle. I forgot what it's called, the pulmonary ventricle. There must be a name for it. This is another thing, but this is chamber number three. Now, attached to chamber number three is chamber number three prime. That is, it's called an orosol. All right. Now, you may not like this, but I have to tell you this. Your body has eight chambers, your heart has six chambers, and it has hooked onto it a pressure relief stabilization chamber called an orosol. And this is, it's a funny structure, heart dynamics, it's a funny structure, and it can expand, take up the high pressure stuff, and then stabilize the pressure and drain into your in terms of the pressure wave coming through, you can see the pressure wave comes through and it fills the orosols a bit at the start of the pump, and then the orosol itself and the rest of your arteries feed it low and just pump up your atrium. If you didn't have the orosol there, you just blow the atrium right off. Poof! Okay, because the atrium is got to be light, because it's next thing is to pump through the next valve, which is, I think, the mitral valve, and that pumps into your ventricle at the front of your heart, which is the pulmonary ventricle. Pulmonary is giving you a bit of an idea, and what that does is that that pumps, so that's number four, so let's go one, two, three, three prime. Okay, got that thing. And valve in between each of those stages, except three and three prime. They're just a different structure. Now, can I just have a stop about the orosols, the three primes? They are ears. They're called orosols because it's like the ears, and the Romans thought they're ears. And you say, how come I don't see them in a normal heart? Gotcha there. Well, that's because you're not a heart surgeon. One of the things is that the body is very fussy and everything is wrapped for convenience. And all your organs are wrapped in a membrane, which are great because you can poke through that and actually fill that up with air for keyhole surgery. Okay, I'm not going to go. I'm going to stop here at the end of here and actually turn around and go up so you'll hear me. I'm just going to take this very slowly as I've walked down to the Glenbrook Gorge. It's a beautiful, beautiful night at the moment here. And, I haven't eaten much dinner. I ate a small piece of fish, but my gut's really distended. I don't quite understand it. Okay, so let's do some heart surgery. I've got the heart. What does it look like? It's heart-shaped. But what I do is I cut open the plastic bag, the membrane. In the membrane, open it up, and there's the heart. Oh, I can't see it very much because the veins are actually all the plumbing of the heart. The heart has to actually circulate blood to itself in a sort of very funny way. But that's all covered in a layer of fat. So if you want to get to a vein in the heart, you have to cut your way through this very fat, and I suppose you can have a fatty heart. But you'll see these two dog ears. Right, now, and that will flip over. So look it up on the internet, orosols. 3.1, and the only, if you say 3 prime, you won't get anywhere, because that's a podcast special. And the ears, the Romans saw it, and I suppose the Aztecs, anyone who used to rip out hearts would have a bit of a play with them, would say, oh, this heart's got ears. And so, of course, the heart was a soul, and it was like a little mini person. I thought, oh, this has got these, I thought, what are these flaps? They look like ears. Pretty funny ears, if you ask me. It's sort of like the lop ears. You know a lop ear bunny? They're lop ears. You've got a lop ear heart, orosols. So that's 6 valves, 8 chambers, and can I say, if you go to a party, there's more than a couple of people, friends of mine, who I've explained things to, and then they've said, got it, and then they've gone up and explained it to someone else, and they've just been punched in the face. I do not joke. They've just been punched in the face. I know to shut up. So, warning with this information, you have to shut up about it. Okay, so we're 1, 2, 3, going into the fourth one, is the front of the heart ventricle. And this is a fairly powerful muscle. This pumps it into the lungs. Okay, so the great thing was that in the 2 going to 3, it went through resistance, and that resistance is the blood being pushed through all these tiny little tubes, feeding every little cell directly, or the cell may have a buddy which isn't near the blood cell, but that it will feed a cell which will then feed the next cell up. In the brain, blood does not flow into the brain. Okay. Blood does not flow into the brain. There's blood supply into the brain, but the brain itself is the blood-brain barrier. Now, what a blood-brain barrier means is that no blood flows into the brain. The little capillaries have brain cells around them, which says you can't come in. However, thank you very much, I'll take a bit of nutrient, and the nutrients actually travel through the cell to the neurons. Isn't that amazing? So, blood-brain barrier. No blood goes into the brain because the brain's that type of organ. In fact, the blood-brain barrier goes right down your spinal cord. In fact, your brain technically goes from your ass. There's a little, it's held sort of pretty exposed. There's some sort of creepy thing up your spinal cord. So your spinal cord is a cord, and it's actually sitting behind the back of your backbone. It's got little armor-plated plates on it. But it's all nice and exposed, and it goes up into your brain, and then that cord goes into your brain cavity, probably through a little hole in the back of your skull. If you ever picked up a skull, look at the back, and you can stick your finger in the hole. But indeed, no, the capillaries are going around the place, but they're going around the place. That's just another interesting thing. But we've gone up to four pumps it down a very another short artery. But that artery is exactly the same. It can expand much less dramatically, but it artery between your atrium number 4 and number 5 is this short little bit of tube between your heart and your lungs, the artery which connects it there, and that too can compress. Otherwise, if it didn't take the pressure, if it didn't dampen the pressure, your lungs would just blow out with blood. So it damps the pressure up and then squeezes it through. So it goes chunk chunk, and this has to be a little chamber which slowly bleeds the blood through. Come on, it feeds it through the lung slowly. So there's another chamber. I don't know what you call it. The pulmonary artery is another chamber, and it has got a valve behind it and a valve in front of it, which is the veins, pulmonary veins. They also have little valves on them, those little veins, and the blood doesn't flow back. So after it's pushed through, it doesn't flow backwards. It's a one-way. So the pulmonary veins is another, valve. And then that goes into the atrium, which is the entry chamber, right back at the back of the heart, which is chamber number 6. That fills up naturally. So the pressure from the ventricle pushes through in a sudden pump. So it fills up the pulmonary artery. That artery then compresses and fills up time. So dum-dump is your heart working, and then your arteries are just feeding the blood pretty well through to where it's ready for the next one. So that boom boom is okay, is your heart working, and then your arteries are pushing the blood through the last bit. Got it? Pretty easy. So that goes to the atrium, which is also going to prime number 1. So that's 6. So 4, 5 before the lungs goes out. Back in the heart, 6 chambers. So let's do a bit of counting. There's 1, the ventricle at the rear. 2, the aorta, which fronts the rest of the body. 3 and 3 prime is the atrium at the front of the heart. And when it fills up, it pumps number 4. 4 pumps number 5. And 5 goes down to number 6. So let's count them. There's 1, 2, 3, 4. Oh, so 1, 2, 3, 3, 4, 5, 6. Because I've got 2 threes there. I'm going to count the 7. But I know many of you think I'm a liar. You're saying, well, you've told me that there's 8 chambers. Indeed, there is an 8th chamber, and that's 6 prime.
It's the Oracle on the atrium, which comes from the lung. So, again, this is a chamber which can stabilize and take the flow. It's sort of nature has done it, and so you've got various things. I think they say frogs have a three-chamber heart, and octopuses have three hearts, all that type of stuff. We're all heart going through, so that's an interesting phenomena about how the pressure is stabilized by the arteries, the body artery and the pulmonary artery. So that takes the pressure off the heart and feeds the controlled pressure through your body. Then you've got the orosols, and I suppose we have a question to say, why isn't this in our education system? Well, to give you a little snap preview. Okay, so in our education system, we say there's four chambers, and if a student asks other questions, we shut them down. And then, this is just reading across from another example. Why is it important that we get right? It's not important to them. They don't care. I don't think you can argue that. That's a pretty powerful argument, that it's not really important that we get this right for students, and it doesn't affect their real life. In fact, it's really all the everything we tell them is irrelevant, and that's the basis there. So just go across eight chambers, two of them prime chambers on the three and the six, and six valves. Across all have to be rather good. And essentially you have to be active to actually get your whole heart working. At the moment, I'm my legs are pumping, number two, my second chamber. Okay, so here's the deal. The door's shut. There's going to be no moving forward. We could say, well, in so many, 100 years' time, we'll explain this properly. You know, it will slowly get through the textbooks. People will come up. Or we're going to have this other system where there are quizzes, the quality control is put up there, and people who just understand, think, like, I'm not necessarily smart. In fact, I'm probably dumb. I'm probably dumber than the average person because I can't retain something which doesn't make sense. So that will put me dumb. But that being said, we have a system which retains things which don't make sense. And so really, in a certain sense, this quiz and this system of getting multiple choices, tests, expert stories, breaking things up into systems. You can sort of see the circulation system is, I mapped out, is not that miles away from the information circulation system, where I have the same information, like an information supply, and it goes to different organs, the radio program, the class program, personal learning, and it goes through different medias. So you get the information and you put it in space, audio, visual, text, audio the first, and the systems of databases go up here. So the plan is to put this in quiz format, to go forward. But we have other problems here. Why? So that's done, if it's okay. I've got a bit of a walk back. We can get onto the next conundrum as to why, if I made an artificial heart with dye and injected it into a sponge, what would happen is that the blood would go everywhere. Okay, there's sort of capillaries, goes within capillaries, but basically, capillaries let moisture out. And so what would happen is that just the moisture would go everywhere. Be a complete disaster. And with this in mind, knowing this contradiction, saying, so most people, I don't know, when presented with a diagram or an explanation, they just go, oh right, that explains it. Whereas I've been a bit more stupid, think, I don't really understand this. And the people go, chat, well, here's the diagram. Here's the, oh, you must be stupid. But perhaps it's not, because there is actually this amazing chemical in the blood called albumin, which means the white of egg yolk. It doesn't appear white in the blood. Indeed, egg white is not white until you cook it. It's a see-through, it's a globulin thing, and it has the effect of having a higher salt content than the rest of the body. Okay, so and salt has the effect of drawing moisture out of things. So your albumin is this salt which draws, it harvests sodium ions out of your body, making your body sodium poor, the albumin sodium rich, and as water is sort of like a fan of sodium ions, it's the ions that are charged and the water is charged, the water sticks to your albumin, and it doesn't stick to your in your tissue. So this is a osmotic pressure. So it means that your blood pressure is the pressure within your veins and arteries, but it's not the pressure of all the fluid in your body. And the way that it does that is not through physical engineering, but through chemical engineering. I don't know how I'm going to do this for the kiddies, but there are these polyacrylate things with which have a similar lacking of sodium, and these do draw up water. These are little globular balls. And so the main thing this does is, yeah, it does draw effectively water out of your body, but only does that if it has a water pressure gradient, if it has an iron gradient. And the only reason it can have an iron gradient is if it can draw out sodium. Now, the thing is that it means that sodium has to be drawn out of your body, and there's this step I don't quite understand where the kidney, where the sodium gets conveyor belt up. You've got to have a sodium inflow through your diet and a sodium outflow through your excretion. You've got to excrete it, and this is a way that you get your blood pressure is what it's measured. Okay. But it's not the pressure that the cells are exerted to. Because the cells are relatively unsalty compared to your blood. So your blood is quite salty now. The idea, well, salty, it's not sodium chloride, it's sodium albumate. Or sodium, you got the, in albumin, it's a globular molecule, which is more globular than the majority of molecules. It's got, it's fairly high temperature sodium bonds. So it's a fairly rugged globular molecule. And so, so much so that if you basically, well, the British do this. I'm going to say a few things. First of all, I'll say about the salt and the blood. I think my daughter was 8, something like that. And, you know, please can I have a rabbit? And the decision was, no, you cannot have a rabbit. Well, not necessarily for me, because they are a pest. Fraught to the nation, blah blah blah. Went in and I bought her a dwarf rabbit. Okay, now this may as well talk about rabbits. These rabbits, dwarf rabbits. So, I think it's like this: that there's a certain amount of anger in every rabbit. Fixed amount of rabbit, and it's like when you reduce the size of the rabbit, that anger ratio goes up. So your smaller rabbits are really bad tempered. So if you can imagine a distribution, you know, you're walking through several distribution curves. You go into a new space of anger, angry rabbits, small rabbits. In fact, you know, if you had a rabbit the size of a thimble, I'm sure it would actually be a killer. It would get into nuclear reactors and send it critical and stuff like that. But this is a dwarf rabbit, very angry, and I could only handle it with heavy rubber gloves. Of course now, many bigger rabbits later, they're all the most docile, there's one rabbit, we had, which was a rescued lab rabbit, the last rabbit, and it would fall asleep. If you put it on its back to cradle it, it would fall asleep. But when I first bought the rabbit, they said, and you'll want to buy a hutch, and you will also want to buy these wooden nibble things, because they've got these teeth. What? Yeah, they have to nibble all the time on these special, they can't nibble on a stick, they've got to nibble on these expensive, whatever they are. And the rabbit is a baby rabbit, it's going to grow. You'll need, there's a kangaroo going around the back here. Is that right? It's unusual to have a kangaroo up here. Okay, this is a kangaroo. I can't tell. It could be a wallaby. Moved off. Okay, so you need these toys for it, otherwise it's going to get bored, and you know what happens with a bored rabbit. And of course, you need this, a salt lick. Why does a rabbit need a salt lick? Well, rabbits need salt, and if they don't have salt, they will start to bite, draw human blood, so they can get enough salt. Now, of course, I took all of this, I bought the whole lot of things, and afterwards I would just mentioned to people about you know, not directly, but you know, this piece of information you got about rabbits liking blood because of the salt in the blood, and yeah, people wouldn't take me seriously in the first place. So there you go, salt in the blood. So there's osmotic pressure. Now the alum is a pretty amazing molecule. I sort of rather like it. So alum is the stuff in the whey when you get your milk and you curdle it. The juice up the top is the alum. And sometimes when you separate yogurt, you get that liquidy, slightly thicky liquid at the top. Now, the important thing about almond, so you could do this for two things. So almond is in milk, okay? It's a sort of second protein in milk. Why is it there? Well, it's in your blood. I don't know whether it's blood almond or something like that. That would be absolutely stunning. I don't know if it's the same molecule. It's something especially cooked up by the mammary glands. I just don't think it is. I think it perhaps is. But the important thing is that this is what forms a skin of milk. If you heat up your milk and get distracted by a phone call, suddenly you come back, there's a skin there, and you're inevitably... Okay, so there's another thing walking in the bushes up there. I can't tell, see what it is, some sort of creature going up the bushes. And you are asked, I bet you've got a skin in the milk. And he's like, no, no. Of course, once the skin forms in the milk, it changes the flavour, which I think is another chemical reason for it. But the important thing is that you can actually... get skin and get bubbles of moisture, air bubbles in it, by actually blowing steam through the milk. The high temperature forms a little skin and it forms a nice micro froth. That's right, a cappuccino. The froth in the cappuccino. I would bet that, just a bet, that you could put blood in a cappuccino machine and get quite a nice white froth of the blood album. This is what I get. Also the British make blood sausages, and I don't think it's the blood clots. It's liquid, it's non-clotted blood, because clotted blood is more jelly-like. I haven't had a blood sausage, but I know fellow Aussie backpackers who've gone up north and have just been horrified by being fed a blood sausage at breakfast. They love it up there. But I do think that's the heating of it doesn't go so it's different. It's sort of like clotted blood is a bit more... a fibrous thing. Your blood clot is a bit more fibrous inside, whereas alum's a bit more basically a plastic, more solid to go through. So that's another important thing about blood. Now the there's another important chemical in blood, which is, there's hemoglobin, but there's also carbolase, something like that. It's basically, a salt, a molecule, which loves carbon dioxide. And if it's a lot, it really picks it up. And if it's not out there, it goes, oh, here, you can have it. If you want it, I like it a certain amount. So what it does is it goes around picking up the carbon dioxide and going to the lungs, and releasing the carbon dioxide. So it's a fairly simple, dumb process. So it's high carbon dioxide. I'll have to read up about. Now this is the entire thing. I've got 10 multiple choice questions to get out, and I'll have to plan it. And I've forgotten what it's called. Carbolase is a... Oh, there you go. Sorry, there's a frog coming out. Yeah, so that's the important thing of the blood. It's got to... After the heart thing, it's got to have the osmotic pressure. Then it's also got to transport regions of high acidity. So if the carbon dioxide goes into this, so it's basically the coke forming. You know how you've got carbolic acid? It takes out the carbon dioxide and transports it from where the carbon dioxide is made up to your lungs, and when it goes past the lungs, it junks off the carbon dioxide. So it's a one-way street. This thing is equally important as the heme molecule. Now the heme molecule is just a joy. So what happens is that when the heme molecule reaches an acidic environment, due to large carbon dioxide, it goes, I'm not interested in carrying this molecular oxygen around. It gives it out. So essentially, if you can imagine you were in a stuffy room, which is your body, and you're finding it a bit hard and you're breathing, and this little thing goes around and checks every door in this thing, and you're in there just, oh, I can't breathe. It comes around and it says, I can smell some carbon dioxide around here, and it passes in the oxygen. So essentially your blood is intelligent in terms of detecting the carbon dioxide level, and its response to high carbon dioxide acidity is to give out the oxygen. And once it's given out the oxygen, it's now, I've done that, oh, it's no longer more. I sort of rather liked oxygen, and it goes up to the lungs and the oxygen diffuses across there. Now, of course, our lung system is hopelessly inefficient compared to that of the birds and dinosaurs. So, now, of course, this means that a bird has fantastic lung systems that work just great, so much great that they could almost jump into the air and fly with this fantastic lung system. So it's sort of, it's a great lung system. It sort of put them out such that they are now ultimately our dinner. The other thing with the great lung system is that they can, oh, I can breathe in all that methane and dread if you're a canary. Whereas us humans with the inefficient lung systems are, oh, what's the wrong problem, mate? So, there's that aspect of the different lung systems. But you know, this is the other aspect to the circulation system, is the blood having the heme molecule, which is this fantastic quantum mechanical thing, and essentially the protonation of it, the addition of extra protons in it, causes it to bend and flex. So the heme molecule has a inside it an iron jewel, sort of like Iron Man. You know how Iron Man has got a piece of I've forgotten what it's called. I've forgotten the thing of the heart, but there's a little bit of metal in it, and the metal goes one way or the other way. It's too bad. The thing dies instantly. But in essence, each heme molecule has got a little heart, a little iron molecule, and it's got those I really can't remember. Is it nitrogen? I sort of know the shape of the molecule. It's got basically a bedspring of these pentose molecules. Yeah, it is right. It's got nitrogen at the top of those things. I can sort of see it. It's a square, and that's sitting out there, the heme molecule, and that's, it's also got another little nitrogen amino acid sticking up the back, just holding it up there. And that has the beautiful advantage that you can trap a an oxygen atom. Now, trapping a carbon dioxide is chemically, that's believable, because the carbon dioxide dissolves in water and then you get a carbonate, and the carbonate then locks down, so it's got a path. Oxygen is a different wild child, because the oxygen molecule is vibrating and moving. There's nothing to really slow it down, rotating and stuff like that. So the oxygen molecule's interacting with its environment and stuff like that. So you've actually got to get that oxygen molecule to want to stick around the heme molecule. And where does the oxygen bind? How does it bind on top of it? It's something which absolutely fascinates me, whether you can get more than one oxygen atom per heme molecule. I don't doubt that you'd really want it, but the way that oxygen can interact with graphene and things like that is just, and the way that you've got this structure here and water molecules could possibly pass through it, oxygen is a slightly larger molecule, so it's a specialist thing. It's obviously not interested in nitrogen. It's not interested in carbon dioxide. However, carbon monoxide comes in and it basically sticks, and it doesn't have the sensitivity. Carbon monoxide on this particular, so it's carbon and a single oxygen, sticks the heme thing and renders it unusable. And similarly, the cyanide, so CO and CN are two things which just bond to the heme molecule. So if you take cyanide, your heme molecule, now I find it really fascinating, the heme molecule, the way it's structured, will be red. So the red of your blood is from your hemoglobin, and it is red when there's oxygen there. So that means basically absorbs the blue light. Okay, so it gives you sort of a feeling for the delocalized electrons. To be coloured, it's got to be delocalised electrons, pi electrons in this beautiful sort of tennis racket. So imagine him, molecules of the tennis racket, and then when the oxygen's gone, it no longer absorbs blue light. It absorbs red light. So it absorbs red light and becomes, and emits blue, it shifts across. So the oxygen's gone, its absorption band changes to the red. So if it emitted both red and blue, it would appear white. Okay, so you shine a white light on it, you get no red light back, you get blue light back, it appears blue. So what exactly is happening there? It would be fascinating to do a supercomputer model of it all. And amazingly, they can shine a photonic light into you and measure your oxygen level. So you can see the maximum oxygen carrying capacity of the blood, due to a light going in. How that actually works is pretty amazing. So you can get your heart rate, you can put a little LED on your finger, a little ring on your finger, and it can measure your oxygen level. Now, quite honestly, I won't give away, there's a thing that I would definitely do. So, and it's essentially, when you've been trained, so when you're in cardiac rehab, initially, the main thing is you don't split the heart apart, and you don't have another, you know, your heart waves don't go back. And of course, all these stents and stuff like that is all pretty iffy. They're just slowly guiding you up, lifting you up. But further training is that they try and push you, get your, well, watch it and see if your oxygen level drops. It's like it's good for it to, not good to drop, but then, no, to pull off training if your oxygen level drops. And then, when it comes back, you're good to go. Also, so the exercise physiologists know. So I think that's the, what I want to say about the heart, and the general thing is the you know, we really have to work out what be fascinating to work out why it's misunderstood, and I can tell you at a front level that the new information doesn't go down well. But there's the heart as a pump system, and then there's the blood as a system. So the heart of the blood system, 8 chambers, 6 valves, and a generic process per pump. It's the same pump valve configuration all the way through. Otherwise, imagine another section not doing it, it'd be a bit hard to see. Then you've got the osmotic pressure, I suppose you've got clotting, things like that, but you've also got the removal of carbon dioxide from wherever it occurs. So you have this thing which is just pretty good at taking up carbon dioxide just there, and it releases carbon dioxide when there is a low carbon dioxide gradient, that is when the blood is exposed to the air. And then there's the hemoglobin, which is got a certain intelligence to it, and that's just the start of it. I think that really covers circulation, which has got the capacity. Key factors of circulation is pressure to cause the flow, then chemicals to remove oxygen and remove or transport oxygen and carbon dioxide. We then also have nutrients to go in there, and immune defense. So it's got a few major things to look at, but that's the way I'll go. So this is the end of a long podcast. Thanks a lot for listening.
Another podcast, another story comes to a close. It's been a pleasure sharing this moment in time with you. May you discover truly amazing things, understand them, and tell others. Thanks for listening.